gavel to gavel coverage. I didn't want to miss the gavel. I want to thank all of you who did come. I expect members will trickle in. I didn't think we were that busy at this time in the session already, but apparently we are. We have a lot of testimony that we want to hear, and actually some of the testimony will be benefiting people in the audience as well as those who ought to be up in this audience. So I'm feeling very powerful or very not powerful right now. I'm not sure which it is. Mr. Schwartz, are you here?
Yes.
Hi. Why don't you come on up? We do have quite a few people to hear from today. If the testifiers can kind of get to their point relatively quickly, I'm not in the mood to have a lot of dragged out stuff here, and I will tell you that you're done. Just kind of, if you made your point, then it's done now. We want to discuss some of these things. If we get a quorum, we'll move a few amendments in. And I'll announce for the sake of the audience, in full compliment, my plan. I'll announce it later when the members show up. It's my intention to some substance testimony today, both to the bill and to points peripheral to that that are helping me decide what to do. This is actually a division where testimony matters, and we are making quite a bit as we go along here. Tomorrow we're doing much the same. There'll be little amendments along the way. If I get a quorum, we'll tweak up a few things. I'll be among them if you're from the Department of Health. We didn't mean to make you do electronic billing help. The DHS thing. Okay. Save DHS some money. And the providers who are struggling with these boxes of files and forms they have to send in. So you can take note of that. Anyway, and then on Monday, I was hoping to get it all wrapped up Monday with whatever we're going to do to get this shipped off to the full health committee. I've been told that at 6 o'clock there's some Humphrey Institute, something or other going on. We're supposed to stop at 6 to honor with that, whatever it was. So if you want to go to that, you can go. And if we have to drag it into Tuesday, I guess we'll have to. I would like to get done Monday if it's possible. It's not always possible. So, anyway, Mr. Schwartz, you've got a few minutes to address us, and welcome to the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for allowing me to be here tonight. I am going to greatly abbreviate this. My name is John Schwartz, and that's S-C-H-W-A-R-Z. I am director of United Health System, a nonprofit health system research, education, and citizen advocacy group. I was a MCHA policyholder for 4.5 years up until sometime last year. I've been looking into MCHA and high-risk pools in general. I'm going to boil down to the essential point. There's a great deal of misconception about MCHA, specifically its assessment funding and how that works. The single greatest misconception that's being bandied about is the talk of the $100 million or so rounded figure of the assessment collected from health insurers as falling on the backs of small employers and individuals. I'm going to call into question that assumption of the direct one-to-one relationship between the assessment public shoulder premiums, but the quick note to make is that the $5 billion dollar premium base from which the assessment was calculated in 2004. These are rounded numbers, but well agreed on. With a 2% assessment on the $5 billion created $100 million in assessment. The small employer and individual policy market, however, only totaled $1.85 billion in premium revenue for the health insurers and HMOs. So rather than the $100 million applying to small employers and individuals, only about 37% of the assessment relates to their premiums paid for $37 million. So this talk of $100 million and relating to small employers and individuals, far, far off the mark. Of the additional money that goes in to constitute the $5 billion in premium revenue, a little bit more than $2 billion is counted for the administration of the public programs by the HMOs. So $5 billion and $3.2 billion comes from other than small employer, small insurers. So there's not a lot of money there to be saved. It's about $40 a year per small employer or individual policyholder if that cost is directly passed on to them. I call that assumption the prevailing assessment assumption, that that cost gets directly passed on to policyholders of those health insurers. They have all sorts of other revenue that they get that expenses are paid from, and the assessment being one of those, but the others include electricity, rent, mortgage, land, computers, claims, medical claims, all that sort of stuff. So trying to draw the one-to-one direct correlation is an assumption. Everybody makes it. No one has demonstrated it. And I'm going to give you reasons why there's why that needs to be questioned and considered. In accounting theory, there's a bucket of water metaphor relating to revenue and costs. If you take a bucket and you pour revenue into it in the form of water, and you pour it in, that each different stream of revenue that comes in is of a different color, red, white, blue, from various product lines, you end up with a bucket full of murky water. If you scoop some water out to pay an expense, what color is it? Can you say it came from a specific type of revenue stream? No, it's going to be a murky colored water. So that is a metaphor that you need to then consider in more complexly issues of porousness within accounting systems, general ledgers, as far as segregating funds off from each other. With the premium assessment, the central question that cannot ever be verified about the impact of the MSHA assessment fee on policyholders' premiums can't be shown and demonstrated or proven because it involves a hypothetical number. And that hypothetical number is what we would have charged number. This would have charged number had it not been for the MSHA assessment. HMO1 charges $100 in their premium. They say they would charge $100, but they actually charge $102, and they say our proof is that the reason we charge $102 is $2 was charged for the assessment. Our proof is we would have charged $100 had there been no assessment. You can't verify that number. It's impossible. It's hypothetical. And that goes true if you lift the MSHA assessment. If you lift the assessment, you can't verify that they've actually passed on any savings to their premium holders, because it involves the hypothetical number of we would have charged, but we passed on the savings, so therefore we did charge X rather than Y. I think the strongest position to be taken on the effect of the assessment on premium policy or policy's premium prices is a market competitive perspective. The driving factor in what all businesses charge for their products, of goods and services, is what the market will bear. If the market will only bear a certain dollar amount, it makes no sense to charge more than that dollar amount. When the hypothetical HMO1 goes through its price-setting process for premiums, market research may determine that $100 is the maximum, provides the maximum return, rate of return from the market. Charge $101, you start losing money. Charge $99, you don't get as much money in. As they set the price, marketing can say $100 is the max we want to charge. The regulatory person can step in and say, but we have to charge $2 for the MSHA assessment, so we need to charge $102. The market people are going to come back and say, no, if we charge $102, we're getting less revenue, net income in revenue than need be, so we can only charge $100. If they charge, if they didn't have the MSHA assessment, the price they would charge is $100. If they do have the MSHA assessment, the price they charge is $100. The assessment does not alter the price they charge under that type of thinking. Also playing into things like premium prices are all sorts of subjective factors, risk aversion, how much of the market they want to take, all these sorts of things. And while a company may believe that they can present you with an appropriate, accurate, hypothetical would-have charge figure, all of these factors that go into how they set the premium, there's so much subjectivity in there, there's no way to really nail that down. To nail down, because it's a dynamic mix of what they have as projections about this, about that. Another situation is within from their internal accounting standpoint, and I'll reference this exactly to the situation today with the public programs and premium revenue they have. For a product like small employer and individual premiums, there is a market competitiveness issue that would make them not want to pass the MSHA expense on, because that will limit the amount of money that they take in revenue, and what they can do is shift that cost deliberately to other product lines where market competitiveness is not so much of an issue, like with the public programs. The public program administration is not based on market competitiveness like its commercial products. There are regulations for them to cover certain numbers of people, contracts are longer. It's a different dynamic. So they can shift that expense and take it from products like the public program and not hurt themselves in terms of their revenue generation. And so there's an incentive to shift the expense away from commercial products.
Can you kind of finish up?
Yeah. On that note, I just want to point out that the public program business that they do actually accounts for a disproportionately high percentage of their net income. They make more money off their public programs than they do off their commercial products. And in some cases, they're actually subsidizing losses in their commercial products. And one way that this could be figured as for what I just said is through the variations there. 98% of, even if we accept the prevailing assessment presumption of being directly passed on, it's only $37 million, 0.15% of total health spending in Minnesota. Changing that funding structure does nothing to reduce those costs. It just shifts them. It's only $40 per policyholder. But what about the other 98% of their premium costs? Are they hearing the breakdown of administrative overhead, all those sorts of factors that go into why they're paying what they pay? MSHA exists to correct a problem in the market that did not allow for high-risk individuals to be covered. They were deselected. They were cherry-picked out of the market in what is known as a death spiral in health insurance. The two rationales for why the assessment is funded the way it is and should be is the insurance companies have created this problem, so part of the burden should be borne by them. Secondly, if part of the financial cost is borne by their premium holders, that's not a new burden. They would be having higher premium costs if the MSHA policyholders were in that private market and not been excluded. So the policyholders' premiums would be higher.
I think that sums up your
point.
And if some members aren't here today, if you wanted to write us a one-page summary of your testimony, that would probably be beneficial to the
I'm working on a full-blown report on MSHA and progress calls out.
But if you have...
I'll hit the bullet points.
You're not going to need a full-blown report.
Yeah.
There's a one-pager with a few bullet points.
Yeah, I'll hit the bullet points.
I think you
and
have
the basic data.
Some interesting points. So,
any
questions for Mr. Ford? Thank you very much. I appreciate your input. Now we're going to hear more about MSHA. There is an MSHA provision in the DE-8-1, which is what brings us here. Ms. Gruber? Now you have a... Oh, actually, there is a... You do have a handout, right? Mr. Schwartz, you do have a handout, right?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
It's kind of long. I'll submit.
No, I didn't know that was written. This is fine for now. You don't have to go to more burden.
Okay.
Because everybody's not here. There are other things going on at the same time as this. So. Thank you. Ms. Gruber, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have these packets? Is that this?
Yes, sir.
And what are you going to tell us about today?
I'm going to try to give you a brief overview of MCHA. And I hope that you keep your packets as a resource. Let me just tell you what's in there. We've got a general fact sheet. There's an annual report from 2004, which has all kinds of facts and figures, and we have a sheet that has all the premiums for our different products, because sometimes I know your constituents are asking what are our costs of the premiums and so forth. And then our general brochure, should your constituents need to know more about MCHA.
Super. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate that. Chair people, chairman and team members, thank you. My name is Lynn Gruber. I am the president of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. We shorten the name to MCHA or MCHA. The legislature created us in 1976. We are a nonprofit Minnesota corporation. We basically have one function for the state of Minnesota, and that is to offer policies of individual health insurance to folks that have been rejected in the private market due to pre-existing conditions. So the organization was created with the sponsorship of the insurance industry as a way to be able to keep a healthy individual market. We have a mission statement, which the board adopted, to offer health coverage to Minnesota residents who are uninsurable in the private market due to pre-existing conditions. We are regulated in law. Our board of directors comes from a statute. Basically, we have six directors that represent the insurance industry, and now we have a health actuary on there as well, and there are five public directors. Two of them must be policyholders. We have to have two of them that are from outstate Minnesota, and two of them must represent companies that pay our assessments. Department of Commerce is our regulator, and the Commissioner of Commerce has some fairly broad authority over MCHA. Administration, we have a very small executive staff. There's basically three of us that are employed by the Board of Directors, and the rest of the day-to-day operations of MCHA is done through a contract with a Minnesota firm. It's a three-year contract. Right now, Medica has that contract, which they won in 2004. The functions of the writing carrier, which is better known really as the administrator, is to handle the enrollment, claims payment, premium billing and collection, customer service, provision of provider and pharmacy networks, health management, things like case management and disease management and report production. Funding. There are sometimes myths about our funding, so let's put the record straight here. We have two main sources of funding. One is the premium revenue. By law, we are allowed to price our premiums above market. When I say market, we look at the individual market, the market for individual policies in the state of Minnesota. We take the average of the companies that sell that, we weight it by their volume of business, and then we are allowed to set our rates in a range between 101 and 125% of the average in the market. Right now, our premiums are around 120% of what the market is charging for an individual product, so we're at the higher end of our range. Through the years, our members have asked for a variety of deductible plans. Our predominant policy is a $2,000 deductible plan now, but our deductible plans range from $500 all the way to $10,000. So we think we are meeting our members' needs. The higher your deductible, the lower your premiums. We have collected in premium from our members about 50% of what we need to run the operations, and then the other 50% comes from an assessment on all insurance companies that write any kind of health insurance in the state of Minnesota, be it group or individual coverage. Now, the problem with our funding formula in terms of the assessment is that as of the late 70s, the ERISA law was passed by the federal Congress, and we are no longer able to assess self-insured companies. When the plan was created, when the legislature created us, they had thought this through, and they had written the assessment law so that self-insureds would be paying their fair share as well. But that all changed with ERISA, and we are not able to assess self-insured companies, which make up about 50% of the market. So our assessment, which is, again, the difference between premiums and the leftover of operations, is going to be assessed out to the insurance companies in a proportion to their market share. So in our state, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica, Health Partners, the three biggest payers of our assessment, if you will. And I think Mr. Schwartz was trying to explain that most insurance companies will pass those losses on to their insured members in a slightly higher premium, which is around 2% more to pay that MSHA assessment. The true payers, we say, of the MSHA assessment are really small business people and individuals that are still buying an insured product. In terms of eligibility for coverage, basically an applicant for MCHA will have been rejected by one company in the private market within 6 months of application. They will have to be able to prove residency and basically have to be able to afford our premiums. In the last few years, Congress has asked the risk pools in the country to help a couple of special groups, and those are folks that are coming to us through HIPAA, where their group coverage has disappeared, and they can come to us basically automatically. And then there's an HCTC program, which affects really our workers who have lost their jobs due to international trade agreements. So up in the range, we have seen a couple hundred folks that come to MCHA through the HCT program. I told you a little bit about our benefit plans, kind of the old-fashioned deductible plans, 80% coverage, so you paid an out-of-pocket max, and then we start paying at 100%. Our lifetime max is $2.8 million. We have some of the people that come to MCHA come to us because they have run through their lifetime max in a commercial policy. We are just offering now what they call a high deductible health plan, which is a type of deductible plan that you would have to have if you're going to have an HSA, a health savings account. So again, responding to our customers, the high deductible health plan is now available. And then finally, with regard to plans, we still have a little bit of Medicare supplement business left with the emergence of Medicare Part D, the drug benefit. We have recommended that many of our folks go to the private market because they can find as good or better coverage than we can offer them for a lower premium. So we have seen about 50% of our 3,000 members depopulate and go to the private market. We are working to educate them that they really should be looking to the private market. It's really to their advantage to do that. If they want to stay, they can because we have creditable coverage, but again, we'll be working to kind of depopulate that. Then to sum up, Mr. Chair and committee members, just a couple of things on plan statistics. MSHA is the largest risk pool in the country, and we were the second next to Connecticut. So you were very wise in your thinking back in 76. There are now 33 risk pools in the country. 8 other states are going to be creating them in the next 2 years. One of the reasons our population is around 30,000 and the highest in the country is because our premiums are relatively affordable. At the 120% range of market, that is fairly affordable. Most risk pools in the country's premiums are set at 150% of market. So it's one reason why we are bigger, and hopefully we'll stay that way. In terms of the types of where do our dollars go when we pay the claims, looking at 2004 statistics, 31% went to pay physician services, 23% to pharmacy, 25% to inpatient hospital, and 21% to outpatient hospital. I believe our pharmacy rate at 23% of the dollar is going to be a little bit higher than the commercial market. Probably of no surprise to you, the top three diagnostic categories are cardiovascular conditions. That's about 14% of our costs. Neoplasms or cancers cover 13% of our costs. And then musculoskeletal, which is your arthritis and things like that, at 11%. Something that we have more than our fair share of are catastrophic cases, and these are cases where the claims are going to exceed $50,000 in a year. We had 710 catastrophic cases in 2004. That represented 2% of our population, but 34% of our total healthcare spend, which was about 71. The share of this, 34% of those costs were $72 million. Finally, if you get a chance to look at our financials and are interested, the last page of your handout indicates what our revenues are, the expenses, the loss from operations, and then the bottom line will tell you what the assessment is. So every year we're going to zero out because when we see those losses, we know what we have to assess. And the truth of the matter is we can have more assessments than just one, and in terms of cash flow, in the beginning of the year we will start assessing based on estimates of what the final year losses will be. So in 2004, you see in your bottom line there, we had about $110 million worth of losses that got assessed back to insurance companies, who then billed that back, if you will, in higher premiums. And small business and individuals are the predominant payers of that assessment.
Thank you. I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I see the assessments have gone up from 90 to 110 million in the last few years. That's not a linear thing. That must blink up and down. This happens to be way up the last year, but...
Mr. Chairman, again, in the report, you're going to see that mostly the line is going up and not back and forth. We will have a pretty special year in 2006 because we are allowed to use some tobacco settlement dollars that Blue Cross Blue Shield had to distribute to the community. So after a lawsuit was settled, we are able to use about $74 million for the year of 2006. So that will be a very unique year where you will see our assessments will be around $35 million. But after that, again, we've estimated that for 2007, those losses will be back up to about $112 million.
All right. So is it kind of level at the 110, 112, or is it? It seems like it'll be creeping up higher and higher. Is that correct?
I think we've only done our projections, Mr. Chairman, through about 2008, and we do see them creeping up. We see our population kind of leveling off around 30,000, maybe even going down a little bit more, but it's the cost of health care, basically, and the fact that we have fairly reasonable premiums that we're not real aggressive like some other risk pools trying to, you know, put the losses on the back of our members. So I think you're going to see a gradual increase in those losses. I will say that in the past few years, we've been able to institute disease management, which takes a few years to see how they can, how the process itself can reduce costs. And that takes about 2-3 years before you're starting to see that. And Medica has begun that, and we've already seen some good results, just a little bit of data back. But we are hoping that with a combination of case management, disease management, we'll be able to do some cost containment that will, let's say, temper the rate of our increase of losses.
And the percent in your premiums, your 120%, you said there is a proposal that's incorporated into the bill, which actually is Chair Bradley's proposal a couple of years ago. That wouldn't affect you one little bit then today, would it? You wouldn't go to 135 if you could, right?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for bringing that issue up. I think our board has no plans to go to 135. In fact, I circulated your proposal to them to see what their reaction was, and frankly, they were not supportive. They felt that if people think this is the fix to MCHA, it isn't. It would be just something that could happen if some future board wanted to raise them. But again, we're more concerned with a bigger fix to the assessment than trying to get more revenue from members themselves. You know, remember, our members, unlike most of us in the room, are paying 100% of their insurance premiums. Most of us have employers that are paying, for me, it's 85% of my premium. In MCHA, individuals are, when you buy an individual policy, you're paying your whole premium and deductible. So with all due respect, sir, we are not in support of the increasing the rate that the premiums could go.
And the bottom part, I think it went from 101 to 115. That would have no, you're not likely to drop back below one where you are anyway, is that?
Mr. Chair, I've been with MCHA for about 15 years, and my recall of what the boards have done is they are tending to be toward the higher end of the spectrum, and I say that because in the past 2 years we've been able to have a small grant from the federal government to risk pools for a premium subsidy program for our lower income members. So this will be the second year that we are offering a slight subsidy, if you will, to our low-income members that are about at 180% of market. So that's another reason the board feels if we've got that piece, you know, we feel that we can be at the higher end of our range for the moment.
Members have questions? Dr. Westerberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm sorry, I missed most of the testimony here, but I just had a quick question on, with MSHA, do they handle then the Part D coverage too for the Medicare supplement deal, or do people automatically qualify for that and it doesn't have to go through to
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westerberg, good question. We do not handle Part D. We are basically helping to educate our members to go and find a private market product. Having said that, we have creditable coverage, so for those that actually want to stay with us and pay the higher premium, we will be paying their pharmacy claims. But it isn't good for the plan, and it isn't really good for our membership to stay with MCHA. It doesn't make any sense to do that because there is better or as good or better coverage in the private market. And remember, we are not here to compete with the private market in any way, shape, or form. So I think it's been slow. It's been hard for the seniors to understand what this is all about, but we are continuing to have meetings with our seniors and send information out to help them understand that there are wonderful options in the private market, and we'd encourage them to go there.
Representative Powell.
Thanks, Chairman. Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Gruber. It's helpful, and the information you give is very helpful here, too, as well. The question I have is, you've got 30,000 enrollees. That's about 0.6% of the population. Is that about where you figure that should be? Should it be high? Is that too high? Could it go higher? How many people are you capturing here?
Ms. Gruber.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Powell, good question. The highest we've ever been is about 35,000 members. And that was in 1993, a little bit after the insurance reforms had gotten a hold and so forth, and we've kind of depopulated ever since then. Looking at the actuaries' projections, I think they see us dropping a little bit down to maybe 28,000, something like that. But my guess is if the economy stays like it is, if there aren't great changes in the marketplace, we'll probably stick around 30,000 members. If there's a change and there's a movement away from group coverage and the individual market gets bigger, then we'll grow. So we're really, going to be affected by what happens in the individual market in the private sector.
Okay, thank you. That actually prompts two or three other questions, but I think I'll have to think them out, though.
You can think, and I'm going to ask another one. You've heard lots of, I should add a point, people have testified about the division in the last year. It's been a large group of people and a lot of side conversations. And anecdotes from my own practice and others. There are people who wind up in your group who had no idea they were going to be part of your group. They have some minor thing which is under control, and they're really no larger risk than anybody else who. They have to be individuals, and if they were working for us, they'd be in our state pool. You'd never see them. You find yourself often wondering, how did you ever get here to us? With some people, as you look at the people who wind up enrolling, wondering why they wouldn't have been covered by somebody.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're really talking about the world of underwriting. And, what does the private market accept as a risk and take and insure, and what don't they? Our number one reason for rejection is overweight. It's really obesity, and even less than obesity. I mean, obesity is maybe 60 to 100 pounds overweight. It's really kind of a factor of what's happening with human beings and their behavior. If you're concerned about people who shouldn't be in our pool being there, what we try to do once a year is we run a report that indicates how many folks have.
It's just a sideways. They get the insurance companies, thank you. But it's the plans. But I'm curious if you think if there's underwriting, if they're being too rigid with their standards. That's my question, not any fault of yours.
I don't have an opinion one way or the other. But I will tell you that there is more to it than just I didn't have a claim this year. What we've noticed is that people that are marginally chronically ill may have no claims that require them to go beyond their deductible. But you need to really look at their pattern for about 3 years because it's going to go like this. No. You aren't always chronically ill in 1 year. So I think that's why insurers, look at their actuaries. They do their studies on, if you're a type 2 diabetic in your control, what are the chances that they'll, have an incident and so forth. But, we have a pretty free market in terms of underwriting. So that's a question probably for my friend, Mr. John Gross, here behind me in Commerce.
And kind of along the same line here, interesting thinking about one of the, I don't know who told me this anymore, the comment about the proposal to eliminate the MCHA assessment out of the health access fund, which is one of our proposals, not in this division, but elsewhere. And the negative to that would be that it would encourage more of this dumping that goes on. But that's an interesting point. Maybe you can
comment about that, but my real question is, as we assess a smaller and smaller pool of people, the people who would be doing, if there is such a thing as that, or, it's called underwriting standards, if you will, assuming they're universal throughout, as more companies become self-insured, or if they could get a, as we lose chances for people to get individual coverages as people have left the state, is the benefit of the dumping being enjoyed by some of the larger self-insureds, and where they don't have to, they don't have to accept those cases so much, and they're being pushed onto the remaining assessees? And is the assessment, maybe my question is the assessment per group that you assess increasing on a per capita basis over the last year?
Mr. Chair, I understand your question, and we're really talking about dumping. It's probably not the right phrase. We don't see hundreds of people being dumped into MCHA by self-insured. But the trend is, and I'll tell you a dangerous trend to us, is that groups that aren't even very large that are self-insured are lowering their lifetime max to as low as $300,000. Lifetime max.
Really?
Yes. And one group, I don't know if they did it, is a small home health care agency that was going to drop it to $25,000 lifetime. If you're self-insured, you're allowed to do that. Well, where will they go? Well, there's basically one place they're going to go. So at some juncture, ERISA might be tackled. I mean, people might have to go to Congress and, you know, tackle that, because that's not the intention, I don't think, of that law. I don't think that's what self-insurers really want to do. So it's, you know, it's really a bigger problem. But
here's what I was getting at. Yeah. If indeed, let's pretend that and having making the plans for, this is just an alternate way to insure people, and so someone's paying. There's nothing free. But if it's increased per capita by, say, 50% over the last 10 years as the market has shrunk, that we can assess, maybe a partial takeover of the MCHA assessment would put that back to what it used to be in terms of who's the plan that, you know, our HMOs and so on who are paying the assessment, to put it back to right-size it to what it would have been when it first started. So the burden of the state would bear part of it, or actually the providers or whoever. Somebody's paying somewhere. That's more of a comment, but is that...
Mr. Chair?
Does that make some sense? A partial takeover would make more sense than a full one?
Well...
Keep the inhibition...
We may have a difference of opinion, but our board is very comfortable with the Healthcare Access Fund being a source, maybe not the only source, but a source of future funding for MCHA. And the reason is, everybody has to pay into it, whether or not you're self-insured or you are. It's been proven in federal court. So we know that that is a very broad pool for us to look at, and we think it's a fair one, and it's related to health care. So we like it. We like the idea.
Did you think you were going
to... My card's there. If you need to call me.
No. All right. No, actually, Mr. Chairman, I have it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as you dig into one part of this, is a whole... big jigsaw puzzle. When you take away one piece and it, like jello, kind of squishes over to there. That's not a very good word picture. Well, I think we've you've been very helpful.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, and I'll be back sometime.
Appreciate
it. Mr. Brinkman, are you here? You by yourself there, or you got the wall set?
Mr. Warren, yeah.
Well, welcome to the, do you have a handout?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Here comes the handout. Super. This you can start. And
all right. Thank you.
Your handout.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Paul Brinkman. I currently serve as Executive Director of the Northeast Service Cooperative in Mountain Iron. Along with a variety of sister service cooperatives in the state, we have a long history of containing costs to the benefit of our insurance pools, over 600 member schools, cities, counties, and other agencies, and more than 60,000 Minnesota policyholders. We'd like to focus today on five broad components of cost containment, presenting tangible evidence of successful collaborative efforts. Now, we'll work from the one-page outline we put in front of you this morning. There are references attached that I'm leaving with you as supporting documents. With one exception, we really won't be going through those reference materials today, except for one notable exception. question. The first component of cost control would be our service model. In other words, the right incentives for choice, innovation, and cost control. Subtle but powerful, our legislative model itself helps explain our ability to assist members in controlling costs. Structurally, participation in the insurance pools is strictly voluntary. Furthermore, service cooperatives have no taxing authority and receive no direct appropriation. Our self-insured pools are advised and governed by the members we serve. On the strategic side, we match the appropriate level of service with the appropriate point of leverage. For example, agreements, RFPs, negotiations, research, and product development are all at the state level. Further negotiations, pooling, guidelines, marketing, education, and governance are at the regional level. Direction collectively and the essential component called flexibility are left in the hands of local decision makers, both labor and management. Specific examples of cost containment include a 4% price advantage under our present agreement with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Contractual penalties to the carrier for underrating. And pool and incentives that further help to modulate premium cost trend. Our second component of cost control would be plan design. Pools and plans that engage employees and energize employers. Although they bring different incentives to the bargaining table, both labor and management, we all know this, they're looking for options in containing health care costs. Now, for the most part, these same folks would like to identify sustainable alternatives to traditional health insurance. Although it's not a panacea, consumer-directed health plans, matching a high-deductible health plan to a consumer-directed health savings account, have a profound way of changing the conversation and redistributing the health care pie. For example, in our case, growing numbers of our members now have better control over health care expenses through consumer-directed health plans, primarily VIVA, but HSA and others. For example, we have 9,000 contracts. That represents about 15% of our penetration for members served, and $15 million in trust accounts that are held by those individuals. Consumer-directed models will help rewrite provider incentives. Third component of cost control would be administrative costs, maximizing premium dollars to pay claims. In a report published for our school pools in September 2002, actuaries at Reedon and Anders identified administrative expenses of only 6.8% among service cooperatives at a time when standard Blue Cross Blue Shield retention was reported at over 9%. In a separate report published for the city-county other governmental pool in August of 2005, 3 years later, actuaries at Milliman USA reported administrative expenses for service cooperative pools at around 6% when competitive offerings such as those available through CGIP were reported in the actuarial study at 8%. Service cooperatives have a long history of highly competitive administrative cost controls, including fixed administrative costs that help minimize premium cost trend, incentives that shift focus to other components of value and cost, expertise available for many walks of life at all levels of delivery, and actuarially reported cost reductions of up to 2% since 2002.
Mr. Brinkman, on that,
yes, sir.
On that admin piece, if you were, you followed this division for a while, there used to be the Medica plan. It was actually just a list out of the statute, I think, that we were comparing. Is that 6.8% compared with the same apples to apples list that would be all the admin relative to the, claims management, disease, not the disease management part, because that was considered to be a health cost. But all the other parts, is that a comparable number?
Mr. Chairman, members, and some of this is available in the documentation, the answer is yes.
That includes, there was a report you responded to a different time, by a certain auditor and so on, and that includes those costs as well, the 6.8 and the 6.0, that cost as well, that
yes.
Per month.
Yes.
That's from Westerberg.
Just to that point then, does that include agent commissions then, or selling commissions too?
I'd have to look at the information. Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Westerberg, I'd have to look at the information. I'd hate to go on the record and say yes. I will tell you this. It would be an apples-to-apples comparison. In other words, agent commissions wouldn't be dumped into the 8% to make it look higher and then withheld for the 6.8%. It would be an apples-to-apples comparison.
Go on. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fourth component of cost containment would be tracking, evaluating, adjusting, and reporting data that informs decision-making. Our commitment to both internal and independent review and analysis continues. One example of adjusting to new information over time can be found in our approach to stop-loss levels or reinsurance. Simply put, managing the risk of high-cost claims. In 2002, Reedon and Anders recommended that NESC, our particular service cooperative, and its members stay with a $50,000 stop-loss level. At the time, the data supported the recommendation and we followed through. 2 years later, NESC insurance consultants presented new data that suggested that we migrate to a $200,000 stop-loss level. Our advisory committee supported that recommendation, and the members were rewarded with a $237,000 net savings to the school pool alone. Today, we're reviewing data, some of which has prompted support for House File 3131, which suggests that we consider new models for reinsurance as a broader cost containment strategy statewide. In other words, this ongoing improvement cycle has helped us understand and communicate with our members that a solid recommendation in 2002 may no longer be valid in 2006. We've already changed it once. We're looking to change it again. Another example of how the data helps us revisit assumptions is illustrated in recently expanded tracking reports. You're seeing documents in progress. In the bottom of your document set, we have a series of graphs stapled together. Gray background line graphs. Should be at the very bottom of your packet, Mr. Chairman and members. If you pull that out, go to about the third to the last page, maybe it's the fourth to the last page, you'll see a document that has not only one dark blue line, but a series of two different colored lines on the far right side. The title of this particular graph is Northeast Service Cooperative ISD Pool, Actual versus Trend Aggregate Increases. Again, these documents are hot off the press because we're doing some additional benchmarking in our region. What I want to point out in this particular graph is the fuchsia line from 2004 through 2006 shows the estimated trend from an actuary study published under legislative approval in 2004. The light blue line shows the actual Blue Cross Blue Shield trend during that same period of time. And the dark blue line shows the actual renewal rate given to our members on an aggregate basis in the Northeast region. So depending upon how you slice the data, the estimated trend from the actuary study published 2 years ago is highest, the actual trend slightly lower, and the actual aggregate increases given our members is lower still. Now, here's where data helps. Some people might say, well, you're buying that because you're being reviewed. You go two more pages, you'll notice that our RSR, Rate Stabilization Reserve, during that period has become even healthier. In fact, if some of our superintendents and some of our key labor people were here today, they'd say it's too healthy. We're looking at that as part of our incentive for the upcoming renewal. The following page shows the RSR adjusted as a percent of the funding mechanism, and again, very healthy during the same period of time. Again, an example of how data is used to review what we're doing and follow through in modulating our assumptions and making appropriate changes. Finally, the fifth component of cost containment we wanted to offer today, current initiatives, in other words, our ongoing resolve, along with legislative leadership to reset the bar. Our membership model allows us the flexibility to respond to local needs and offer referrals when other programs better complement our member needs. For example, the rollout of Medicare Part D, whatever your inclination or politics may be, gave us a golden opportunity to work outside the box. Some service cooperatives suggested alternatives to Blue Cross, including Medicare products through Humana, and more recently, the potential of products through Health Partners. We take a similar approach to members looking to migrate away from unfunded long-term insurance liabilities by sharing best practices, encouraging vigorous labor management engagement at the local level, and recommending retirement health care program alternatives, such as the Minnesota State Retirement System, something that we endorse for our members. There's no fee. We just say it's a good product. take a look at it, and some of the members look at that particular product. They do a good job. Finally, we want to close by saying we endorse common ground reform proposals such as the reinsurance initiatives outlined in House File 3131 or House File 2832 as complementary to many local engagement models already found in hundreds of rural settings in and outside of our pools and in dozens of metro settings such as Hopkins and North St. Paul. Reform must either complement or reward local innovation, not undo what already works. On behalf of our members, we wish you the best in your work over the days and weeks ahead. Will you please consider us in your plans for health care reform and let me know if we can help in any way. Thank you for this opportunity to present today.
Members have questions? Could you tell me what House File 3131 is? Is that the Socorro bill? And what does that do?
Mr. Chair, members, Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Service Cooperatives. House File 3131 was introduced about a week ago, and what it would allow is for a service cooperative or a group of service cooperatives to put together a reinsurance association for local units of government. So the current existing customer base that the service cooperatives deal with, not expanding outside into the private market. What we envision is a voluntary arrangement whereby local units of government could come together, put a program together to pool their catastrophic claims. So you leave that local flexibility to design your health plan locally, but then to deal with catastrophic claims so smaller local units of government aren't hit by the a bad wheel of fortune in one particular year. That's what we're trying to envision with that legislation.
So you would actually be pooling the reinsurance exposure, not pooling the basic plan.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
At a $200,000 limit?
Or
whatever you're thinking of.
Yeah, it would have to be negotiated with those who wanted to join.
Is that because the local groups can't find a reinsurer or because they can't find competitive reinsurers?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's actually around the data, just as we discussed. Some of it's found in your materials, and we'd be happy to come back and talk about it further at another time. Basically, in short, Reading and Anders, for example, was able to demonstrate that we were fine in 2002 at the regional level. There was data to support that. 2 years later, as we said, we started moving our stop-loss levels up. And here in the last year, we've been reviewing trend data going back 5 to 6 years that's showing us that, frankly, we're paying too much in health care reinsurance. And now's the time to capture some of the money back and redistribute it to the pool, probably in the neighborhood of 1%. But I am shooting from the hip with that number.
And so you would then take this now pool of people and go shop the international reinsurance market? You would not be the reinsurer. You would go buy some.
Right.
This is actually just a way to pool to go buy some more.
Right.
At a better price, because you'd now have... How many lives are in the Northeast Co-op?
In the Northeast Service Co-op, about 7,000 member contracts.
You know what does that mean?
So about maybe 20,000 covered lives.
Okay. And so then all the co-ops would join together. That's your joint co-op plus. So you might have 100,000 lives or better.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Which would then make you some kind of a dealer, then you'd have a little more co-op to go negotiate. That's the whole idea?
We would hope so, Mr. Chairman.
Theory to be tested, is that what that is?
Well, in part it's a theory, but remember, we would love to have legislative support and leadership on this issue. At the same time, as mentioned in my comments, we are going to explore options for stop-loss on our own in the meantime with our members. It's part of what we do.
Do you need permission to establish that kind of a group? Is it not lawful to do it otherwise?
We've talked about that.
Mr. Chair, I think that question is unanswered for us at this time. And we thought with legislative approval, it would make it clear in the marketplace that we do have that authority to go on.
But you might have the authority now, but you don't.
Mr. Chair, I'm not...
Yes, I don't want to start the court case later on. Well, you see, got the wrong answer.
I thought we would have clear authority, Mr. Chair, if it was in statute.
Yeah, I understand. Anything else you want to say?
Thank you, Mr.
They may stand down. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. It's a young move, yeah. And Ms. Rowan, are you next? No, Liz Quam is next. Maybe just, do you want to react to that or do you want to do the... Well, I think that, because we're going to, actually be more, let's have you come up. Well, because I saw a look on your face, so I thought that was interesting. Also, you have a report for us.
I have to work on my focus.
But I'm interested to And so, could you react to what we just heard about that pooling thing? Is that that's all in the private market? So that would be good news for the insurers, right? That they would have to deal with. They would deal with.
If I understood, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I haven't seen House File 3131, so it's hard for me to react. But if I understood, they're talking about pooling their co-ops and then going as a group to buy stop loss insurance, which is they're looking to the private marketplace for a solution. So.
Yeah. So that's good news.
I haven't read the bill, but in concept.
You could buy it from my reinsurance association. How about? Would you like that?
Mr. Chairman.
Sure helps.
You think the private marketplace is exceedingly vibrant and healthy, and they would find lovely options out in the marketplace. And I need to go to the reinsurance club.
This is just getting too easy for you. Okay, why don't you, you have a brief report for us that you were going to bring. And in your notes, there's a one-pager. I have my copy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when my colleague Bob Johnson and I were here before the committee last week, we were given two homework assignments. And so I am here having completed our homework to report on the results of the questions we were asked. The first question we were asked is how stop-loss rates in Minnesota compare to some of the other states and whether or not we were subsidizing care in the other states. And what you have in front of you is a regional map with some average stop-loss costs of some of our neighboring states. Please keep in mind the data is from 2004, and it doesn't make allowances for differences in deductible or attachment points. But it does give you a good idea of where Minnesota compares relative to other states. And Minnesota actually comes in right about middle of the pack. The Dakotas are higher, Wisconsin is higher, Iowa is lower, as is Ohio.
And you thought that the Iowa thing might be a different deductible.
Right. The stop loss carriers we talked to who compiled this data thought that they tended to have, no particular reason why, but they tended to have higher attachment points in Iowa.
So the guy who says come to South Dakota, he's like way off on this one. So they should, the insurance is way more expensive in South Dakota. Listen to that at home.
Yes, stop loss is more expensive than South Dakota. And it does have to do with the fact that we have much more efficient networks in Minnesota. And with respect to the question of whether, to what extent we're subsidizing other states, with respect to aggregate stop loss, that is very much experience rated and reflects the cost of Minnesota care.
And how does New York and Florida compare? Do we get any data about that?
New York and Florida, they had fewer carriers that they had data available for, so they felt it was not reliable.
Yeah.
But both New York and Florida come in higher than Minnesota does, and higher than the Dakota as well.
Okay. And then you have a second part.
The second part of the question was, what about, MIWAs or other new groups that are created? Where, will stop-loss carriers write them, or where do they go for options? And our folks looked at Minnesota. I don't believe we actually have any MIWAs now, but they looked at the laws that were in place regulating MIWAs, and they came across a provision that, for them, would inhibit the market. In other words, if there was a viable, financially sound MIWA out there, that this provision would essentially prevent them from writing it, in their view. And that provision is found in 62H.02, and what it essentially does is require the stop-loss carrier to function almost as part of a life health guarantee fund. In other words, to accept part of the risk of the financial viability of the MIWA, and stop-loss carriers are not equipped to do that. They don't surplus for that. They don't put away surplus for that. They don't reserve for that. They're meant to handle the excess loss, not the actual viability, or to take care of the MIWA if it in fact goes under. So they saw that as a market inhibitor.
I did ask Mr. Gross about that. We chatted in fact with you, and he says the commissioner can waive that if he's comfortable with the deal, which is an interesting thing. Representative Westberg, did you? Okay. Which I thought was a positive thing, but it's an unusual burden. And you said only Indiana has that as well as us.
Our folks were only aware of one other state that did it, was Indiana, but that was not, a scientific exhaustive survey. That's just, they said they could only think of Indiana.
But not South Dakota. So that's another reason to go back to South Dakota, because they have this law there. Okay. So one for us and one for them. Any questions about that? Mr. Pender, do you have any?
No.
Is that interesting for you?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
If that's the question I asked. Well, that's, I think, helpful for now. Anything else you want to say? Thank you. So, no, Ms. Kwan, why don't you come up? I think actually with that out of the way, that kind of helps set you up a little bit for your discussion. So we're, this is a graduate level course you're taking, so we're all learning a lot about stop loss and how to pool as a co-op. And welcome to the division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a handout? Or do you have something?
I have three handouts.
Are they in front of
you? And I'm going to talk to you about all three of them.
But I'll be quick about it.
Great. And I actually really enjoyed all of those that testified before me. It was interesting. I am Liz Kwan, volunteer executive vice president of the decade-old rabble-rousing nonprofit organization, EMOM. Our mission is to foster more healthcare options for Main Street providers and employers. I bring special greetings from our president, Tom Jorgens, an international businessman based in Crookston, our vice president, who is a provider in Duluth, and our secretary, Lisa Paxson, who is CEO of the Brainerd Lakes Area Chambers. The rest of our board members are listed in one of the handouts. My day job is as director of the CDI Institute, where I am working to define nationally accepted measurable indicators of quality and imaging services. As most of you know, rural healthcare remains another passion of mine, so I wear my cap as president of Minnesota Rural Health Association often and usually all of the time as well. I brought three handouts with me. The first is AMOM's 10-year assessment and report card. You might have seen that before. The second is a letter from a respected ERISA MIWA attorney. And the third is a white paper from the West Central Minnesota Healthcare Purchasing Alliance, which truly is hot off the press. Please allow me to offer some comments based on these handouts. After years of providing technical assistance to employer and provider groups across the state and elsewhere, AMOM has paused in our community activity. We don't want to encourage community leaders to invest resources on options which are not viable under the current law and/or administration. More on that in a minute. AMOM continues to push forward on five issues of importance to healthcare providers and smaller employers throughout the state. They are, and they're the recommendations that are in the 10-year assessment. First is cost disclosure, which will build consumer demand for quality information. You've all heard this theme from us for several years. We no longer are the voice crying in the wilderness, and that is refreshing and hopeful of more progress to come. Second, cost disclosure must include transparency of broker rewards, both direct compensation and other incentives, especially for those based on volume directed toward a specific health plan. In a campaign year, I am not sure I'd recommend any of you initiate the broker disclosure, but if you do, I believe that there would be significant changes in the current situation.
You could do it.
Third, interoperable electronic medical records and quality measures that allow smaller providers to compete are key to maintaining a strong, innovative provider system. Currently, we have some hospital systems who are trying to shut out other providers by telling patients that the patient must stay within the hospital system for all services in order for their records to be included on their EMR or electronic health record. This, by the way, is a big issue in rural areas especially. Four, before and when considering allowing for-profit entities into our health care system, AMOM strongly recommends that there be a clarification of how to earn and re-earn nonprofit status in this state. The nonprofit status is supposedly indicative of a community benefit, yet that benefit is not clearly defined anymore anyplace, either in state law or IRS federal code. Minnesota of all states should lead the way on articulating what we expect to be delivered as a community benefit of a nonprofit health system or health plan. One of the suggestions I made to the Citizens League was maybe if that new hospital is going to go in Maple Grove, maybe that hospital should be required to offer the community benefit of both quality and cost disclosure. get it started there as a nonprofit requirement. And finally, our fifth recommendation is based on the experience of the Employers Association with its attempt to do a MELA. Aon believes we do not yet have any good options to offer our eroding base of small employers. And you do have a handout in there from another group talking about the continuing eroding base of small employers. Which brings me to the second handout, which is a self-explanatory as to what transpired between the Commerce Department and the Employers Association. I have two additional comments with that. AMON's former president, Dr. Hightoff, has requested that Senator Johnson and Speaker Sillingham take a look at the Employers Association debacle further. That and the jury letter needs to be the end of the discussion on that MELA for at least for the session. And the reason is because it is distracting to other groups that are out there and want to do something. I would plead with you that we focus on the results of this failure of the MELA to launch. Having no other option, the Employers Association, who represents mainly mid-sized manufacturers in the Twin Cities area, St. Cloud and Duluth, the Employers Association is now assisting its members who are large enough to individually self-insure. And you heard about some of the problems with that from Ling Ruber. While this is the only option for many of these members, other than dropping health care coverage for their employees, the ramifications of it should give you, as a legislator, pause. It pulls these companies out of state regulatory oversight into the federal ERISA system. It pulls these companies completely out of the assessment for EMTA, upping the cost for that, also premium tax. Despite the consumer protection concern touted when we were going through the MELA process, the end result of this failure is much less consumer protection for those employees who will now be working for a mid-sized company that is self-insured. If a self-insured company goes belly up, so does the health care coverage, unless we bump them back into EMTA. Which brings me to my final handout. While watching the efforts by the Employers Association closely, a group of agriculture co-ops in South Central Minnesota and the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance have continued to meet and try to find solutions for their area businesses. Indeed, twice the U.S. Congress has voted their confidence in the co-ops project, earmarking over $4 million for that effort here and in Minnesota through the USDA. The West Central Group presents to all of us the enclosed white paper discussion, which indicates they aren't sure what their next step should be and are flexible on how to move forward. Mr. Chair, I look forward to working with you on your MEEP and PEEP bill in hopes that through that avenue we can offer these rural purchasing alliances new options and hope for their community. Thank you very much for your constant and caring concern for the working uninsured throughout our state, especially in the rural areas. I hope you have and will continue to be inspired by the efforts of so many of these citizens who are everyday heroes who continue to work to make it better for their own community.
I have a few questions. When you were setting up your MELA.
For the employees.
Yeah, the one that you did. That would have been, you were looking at how many employees. Was that 1,000 or something?
Oh, no. It was 13. We thought that we would start with 13,000. I don't know if that was lives or employees. I'm sorry, I can't remember.
That's enough.
It was 13,000.
A number of different companies together.
Yes.
And they would have been rated as a group, or would they have been rated as companies?
They would have been individually rated going in, and then it would be a community rating for any increases, with a three-year commitment of all of them to Jan.
And so then they would have been locked in at their rate, and then they would have gone up trend-wise.
Gone up or down. It would have stabilized. Their main concern, what we hear from mid-sized and smaller employers, is they just need some stabilization. They can't do the spikes and manage their business.
And would they have equalized over time, or would they have stayed different?
Yes.
So they would have over time gone from here to level up.
And one of the reasons that that is, excuse me, Mr. Chair, but why that is of such interest is, and why we've grouped the purchasing alliances together when we've looked at the MIWA, is there's something called Taft-Hartley Trusts, which are like industry collectively bargain groups, which are under federal law. But when we looked at how to set these up so that it would be responsible, we wanted to put like industries together. So mid-sized manufacturers, while they aren't all pipe fitters like you find in a Taft-Hartley, at least there's a like industry. And we think with that, whether it's medical condition types of research and prevention to even just predicting rates of increase might be easier to do.
Some more questions. Anybody else have a question while I'm thinking of mine? That's from Essenberg. Do you want to?
Just in looking at this West Central Minnesota Healthcare Purchasing Alliance here, I find it kind of interesting that that they decided to eliminate the state mandated benefits in this thing, and then with still having like number seven that requirement here on that there would be the ability to shift the cost for high-risk patients, to other another program here. Adverse selection has to be... I don't see that it's solving the problem, if they're allowing that to happen with this type of a thing. But could you just tell me what your thoughts are on that? I mean, as far as from the standpoint of allowing, first of all, I guess, the fact that this particular type of a program would not have any state-mandated benefits in it. And... what your thoughts are on doing something like this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westberg, first of all, what this is a white paper drafted by someone from the University of Minnesota Morris discussing what they had looked at, what were options. I don't think they're presenting this as recommendations all the way around. This is more a discussion of things that came up as concerns, and if it seems appropriate to request the differences. Now, having said that, with the mandated benefits, if there is absolutely anything that I've heard over and over again, is that small employers want to offer their employees a decent benefits set, not one where there's $30,000 of lifetime coverage, not one that doesn't have maternity benefits. They want coverage for their employees. With a small company, they're like family members. They're people that have worked together, 7-8 people that have worked together. The average size of a small business or a business in rural Minnesota is 9. They're small groups. They want the right thing for their employees. So even that they put this in does not mean that they're looking at a skinny benefit set. And the other one that you talked about was 7. One of the things that we see with self-insured companies, and it's probably against the law, so maybe I'm admitting that here, because I have offered that suggestion to self-insured companies where the reinsurance premium goes up higher than the value of their business because of one employee, is with those self-insured companies, the MCHA has become the option for that person to now become the option for that person to now become a full-time consultant to the company and pay for his own healthcare coverage. While that isn't, there aren't that many instances of it, it is certainly something that the purchasing alliances have heard of directly from some of those companies in rural Minnesota. So if we're trying to, what you have to do is compare per member per month premium costs with a comparable benefit set with maybe a large self-insured company to really look at what's comparable. And then from there you have to look at where the extra expenses are for small businesses and individuals that you don't have elsewhere.
And that's interesting. And actually, we talked about this self-insured dumping. I didn't realize that was so close. And interesting. This has been interesting dialogue today. When you're with your MIWA, do you have to? You can rate how you like age rating. Are you allowed to age rate Or were you planning to do that in the new?
Is John? I don't know if Mr. Gross might remember. There are a couple things that you can rate on. It's federal. It's federally required what you can.
Yeah.
Same as it would be for ERISA companies.
And so, maybe the plans in the audience, the third one, can they age rate? Are you allowed to age rate? No, just in general. Yeah, but those.
Mr. Chair, you have to go to a self-insured model, not the.
Oh, so you can't.
Not the fully insured.
Under a fully insured model, you can't age rate. Is that right? We're not allowed. We don't allow that. The state doesn't allow that, or the small. Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, our laws do allow age rating in both the. Individual and small employer market within some rating bands,
but not in the large group.
We don't regulate premium rating.
Well, they can do whatever they want there. They could age rate or not.
No, Mr. Chair, I think there are federal requirements, and I think it's just age rating. But there might be one other thing that you can rate on.
Right. I'm sorry,
I can't remember.
You're doing fine. And you had a hard time. There was a reserve issue with your thing too. What if that was part of your challenge, wasn't it too?
Mr. Chair, with the Employers Association, what the members were planning to do was do up to a 3-month letter of credit.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Which would solve the reserve thing. But what's provoked my interest in your reading the hard time you had. You had this fight so sore from hitting against the wall too many times. But with the reinsurance, and there was not a large, there weren't many reinsurers wanting to come look after your deal, right? Was there just the one that you wound up with the 31-day withdrawal option, is that?
Mr. Chair, two comments to that. It's a whole heck of a lot better than it was back in 2001 after 9/11 when there just wasn't reinsurance available. Now there are, we're talking to two different reinsurer carriers for the co-ops project. We aren't that far along with West Central Purchasing Alliance. For them, the biggest issue is having to make too many adjustments to their national policies based on little weird things in Minnesota law or requirements on an agency, a regulatory agency. And the reason is not because they don't like to edit their policies. It's because it messes up their how they do their underwriting, how they figure out their risk. If there's too many anomalies to what they're used to doing.
Right, and so is there a bunch of Minnesota stuff in the way you found that was burdensome that wouldn't have been a problem in South Dakota or New York or somewhere? Or was it just the whole, was it the newness of your group? Or was it the Minnesota piece?
It was, Mr. Chair, I think it's how we fixed the law 2 years ago. I don't think we fixed it right. Because what we did was we offered a waiver because AMOM has been so much into we need to do this responsibly, so we want state oversight to it. And I think we just needed to be more specific on what the agency could allow and could not. Because right now, as Ms. Rowan said, there's an issue with the stop loss, the aggregate coverage. And then there's just interpretations that very good, reputable people have intensely disagreed on what is required.
That's helpful, I think, to a point. Any other questions? Last word?
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. I do want to, even though there's only one member here now, I'd like to just make an amendment to the DE. Actually, a technical change, that's a drafting error. I know. But I'm just announcing that it's my intent, and in the electronic assistance, electronic billing part, it said Department of Health. That was meant to be Department of Human Services. So we'll address it again tomorrow, but I want everybody to realize that So if staff or somebody can get a hold of DHS, and if, is DHS here? Okay. Okay, that's fine. So if maybe staff can just touch base with them and let them know that, really probably shouldn't move it since there's so few members here, but just so you know what's going to happen, just to remind people, we're going to be back again tomorrow. We're going to hear from, who's coming? Cal's coming? Biggest Cities is coming. The Tom Pender Show will be in operation with talking about rate banding or something like that. CIU is going to come talk to us. Well, plan show. Who's that? Arch? Yeah. The Jeff Arch show will be on that. And so if there'll be a few amendments then, and there will have some discussion, I hope. I believe this has been a productive dialogue in the policy of it. This is, I think that we now are much more informed, a group of members and the body at large. Even staff, I think, has picked up a few nuances. So I think this has been very productive. I expect we'll be done at about the same time tomorrow. Because of this Humphrey, whatever that thing is, on Monday night, we're going to stop by 6 on Monday as well. Maybe we'll be done by then, if not very soon after that. So thank you, Roger.